Hello, Lopez. I'm Lorna Reese, host of Lopez Writers Read, the show that brings you your friends and neighbors talking about and reading from their own writing. In each program, we talk with a featured writer about their work and their process, and they read some of their work to us, too. This show is being pre-recorded in August 2010. I'm very excited today to have my guest, John Sangster. I've known John for a few years, and I love his work, which has appeared in several issues of Shark Reef, which, if you don't know by now, is the literary publication of the Lopez Writers Guild, on the web at sharkreef.org. John's chapbook, Island Year, was published by Pudding House Publications in 2008. While working on a memoir about a one-year trip he and his wife took across North America, a number of car poems began to appear. And those, combined with earlier car poems, might one day become a chapbook. What I just read to you now was from the bio on Shark Reef. So I'm going to start out with what might seem like an odd question, John, but I've really been wondering lately, what is a poem? What makes something a poem? Have you got any thoughts about that?
I guess the thoughts I have are, by the way, thank you for having me, Lorna. I'm really happy to be here.
You're welcome.
And participate in this show, which I've enjoyed listening to. I guess I would turn to poets that I've studied, things they've said. And one of my favorite poets is Ted Kooser, who was the poet laureate of the U.S. Some years ago. His definition of a poem was a device through which the ordinary world is seen in a new way. And then another poet that I very much admire is Jack Gilbert. And he said that for a poem to succeed, it needs to make the subject felt.
Oh.
So I guess it's... I can't put it any better than that. It's precise, kind of compressed language that has this kind of other dimension to it. When it succeeds, it's hard to explain, but you know it when you read it.
Right. I know it is hard to explain, and that's why I was thinking about it. It seems like the poem is it's the heart or the germ of a bigger idea, maybe.
Right.
But would you read Ted Kooser's definition one more time? I like
yeah.
that.
He says, a device through which the ordinary world is seen in a new way.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So a poem helps, it reveals something.
Right.
So what do you think about poems that you can't understand? There's a lot of poetry that I can't understand at first reading. Is that because I'm too stupid? Or is it because the references are obscure? You need to have a wider frame of reference for them? Or is it that aren't some poets just kind of beyond the...
I think so.
Because it does bother me, but I like the poems that are clear and you know immediately you do feel something, like
yeah,
you said.
I agree with that. And Kooser, he's written a wonderful book for poets called The Poetry Home Repair Manual. It's kind of a how-to poetry book, and I've gone back to it many times. I think it's a wonderful book for beginning poets and for poets that are further along. But one of his big things is he stresses clarity. Let's see, one of the things that he says are the obstacles between the poet and the reader kept to a minimum. He says a poem that only the poet understands really isn't of much use to the rest of the world. So he's really big on making poems accessible. And I agree with that. I mean, that's what I try to do. Some poems take several readings, and they reveal more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really wonderful thing. Maybe the first time they go by, you miss a lot.
Mm-hmm. But there still has to be something in there that makes you want to read it two
right.
or three times. Something.
Yeah. But there's a whole school of academic poetry, I think sometimes referred to as difficult poetry, that just doesn't appeal to me.
Oh, me too.
Like you.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because I think a lot of people are frightened by poetry. I know I only started reading poetry about 15 years ago. I joined a book group, and we were to bring a poem. I thought, oh my God, what do? I didn't really know. I remembered Robert Frost, and the things we learned in high school, but it was very worrisome for me. But it opened up a whole new world, and I've just been in love with poetry. And let me give a little endorsement here to something you can all get on the web, the Writer's Almanac. Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac, you get a poem a day, and I have discovered some amazing poets that way.
Yeah, Lorna, you actually led me to that website, and I've signed up, and it's wonderful. There's a new poem every day, and also he reads it on NPR, too.
Yes.
He's a wonderful reader. But he also has little snippets about such and such writer was born on this day, they're very interesting. I've learned a lot. And I save some of those in a file on my computer, the ones I really like. But I have to say that in general, maybe one out of 5 or 10 poems are ones that I want to save.
Yeah, I also have 116 poems in a file on my computer. Not all from the Writer's Almanac, but from various sources. But yes, they're not all ones you want to save,
yeah.
But some just really speak to you.
Right. It's a great resource for what's going on in the poetry world. And he published maybe one or two books. One of them's titled, they're anthologies, one of them's titled Good Poems.
Oh, really? Yeah, that would sound like...
Which has a lot of wonderful poems.
Yeah. I'll have to look for that.
Yeah.
There's also Billy
Collins,
who put together a couple of books of like 100 poems that he really liked, and
right.
then a sequel or something.
Yeah.
So I have a couple of those, too.
He's a wonderful, accessible poet.
Exactly.
And one of the things I like in poetry is humor, and... he definitely has that. He has a wonderful facility with language, too.
I was wondering, still talking about poems in general, do you think something needs to change or be realized or observed, like you said, in a new way in a poem? Or can they just be moments in time? Because I've been getting poems submitted to me for the Shark Reef magazine, and some of them... there's an observation or a realization or epiphany, and some of them are beautiful moments in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any thoughts about that? Does something...
Yeah, I think it could be anything. Whitman was an influence on me, and I do a lot of stealing from other poets, other writers, and see if I can find this poem where I took a poem that he'd written and just kind of recast it, entitled it Island Image, and I gave him credit. I titled it Island Image after Whitman. It's three lines. Can I read it?
Yes, please do.
So this is Island Image. From the trail that wanders down to the weathered wooden shack, summer grasses nodding, the glitter of the sea, and sky and water, a distant wash of blue and blue. So that's like just an observation.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Maybe I'm being too... literal. I've been talking to poets, so I've been trying to understand what they're trying to do, I guess, in a poem.
Can be many things.
And maybe sometimes people don't really even know what they're trying to do in a poem. Maybe they're
right.
Just, you know, it's something's coming out, and
right.
And then it's like you spit it up on the page, and then you move it around and see, oh, wow, that's what was coming.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can we talk for a minute about the way a poem looks on the page, and perhaps the difference between hearing a poem and seeing it?
Well, the way a poem looks on the page is very important to me. I once went to a writer's workshop at Centrum, and there was a poet there by the name of Erin Ballou, and she said, the shape of the poem tells you what it wants to be. So I think it's really important how a poem looks on the page. It tells you, as she says, what it wants to be. I write both poems with end breaks, you know, lines, the standard kind of free verse that you see,
mm-hmm.
and prose poems. And prose poems are like, I describe them as, they're left justified, right justified. They look like a box full of words. And I guess they have kind of different purposes. For one thing, a poem with lines, the line break is a powerful tool for a poet.
Because
he can do some interesting, or she can do some interesting things with it.
Does it mark a pause?
Yeah, it's a pause. Yeah, I've often heard poets read their poems where they kind of pause at the end of each line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could read a couple poems and I could read a line poem and a prose poem and try and describe to you what the difference is.
Okay, let's do that. That sounds
okay.
Interesting.
The first poem is a line poem, and it's titled Question. First dance, blue moon, junior high school gym, boys against the east wall, girls against the west. The one with brown eyes, the way her skirt and sweater fit, not tight yet. He asked her, she squeezed his hand, pressed against him too, and he felt crazy. How could he know, the two of them, a lifetime unfolding, all on the turn of a dance.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Very, very beautiful. Very moving.
So the example there is the line where I write, she squeezed his hand, pressed against him too, and he felt crazy. So I did the line break at the end of that line where he says, and he felt, and I put crazy on the line below by
right.
itself. So it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of a more powerful
mm-hmm.
Way than just putting the word crazy right behind felt.
No, I see what you're saying. I have also seen poets who use line breaks differently. It seems like you can't pause until you go on to the next line. And so
right.
It doesn't seem like there's any rule. It's people do it in different ways.
There isn't. One poet I studied with, again, at Centrum, Joseph Stroud, he had a pretty common sense way of doing it. And basically he said, you know, you need to, the line, when you put a line break like I did there,
mm-hmm.
There has to be a reason for doing it. Otherwise, the line should kind of make sense by itself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, just in this poem, the second stanza, the one with brown eyes, that's one line.
Mm-hmm.
Next, the way her skirt and sweater fit.
Yeah.
That's another line,
yeah.
And then not tight yet. So if I'd done like the one with and then did a line break, brown eyes, it probably wouldn't have made sense.
No, I see exactly.
So it's a technique, it's a powerful technique.
Mm-hmm.
And when you write a prose poem, a box of words, you lose that line break.
Well, were you going to read us a line?
Yeah,
one
read
of
you
those
rose.
Two, because then I have a question about that.
Okay. Prose poems. The thing about prose poems is, I could talk a lot about them, but they look like prose, but they use poetic techniques. They use sound value of words, and they use internal rhyme and slant rhyme and rhythm, and they can use simile and metaphor, all those poetic techniques. This particular poem is titled What We Carried, and it comes from this memoir that I'm working on, which is about a trip that my wife Patsy and I took when we both turned 50. We were at a point in our life where our children were out of the nest, and we were kind of stalled out in our careers. I was, in truth, having a midlife crisis. And we took off for a year in a little camper and went across the country. And so I'm writing this memoir. I'm writing it with prose. I'm writing it in prose, but I'm including poems. And so this is, early in the memoir, I wrote two poems, What We Carried and What Carried Us. And so this is What We Carried. Oh, and by the way, I refer to Patsy in these poems as Brown Eyes. What We Carried. Brown Eyes fiddle and my guitar, road atlas and an alphabetized accordion folder with clippings, what to see and do in New Orleans, first aid kit, hide a key, fix a flat, rope, shovel, bucket, jumper cables, fold-out tables, two aluminum chairs, and a flower vase. Think Tom Joad's truck 50 years later. Kitchen gear, cookbooks, corkscrew, whisk broom, and a mousetrap for the one that jumped aboard at Apgar Creek Campground on Idaho's Locksaw River. The one that woke us up breaking and entering the taco chips. Birding glasses, bug juice, sunblock, CB radio for the good buddies, field guides, birds, wildflowers, campgrounds, parks, Nikon F, three lenses, Zenith 9-inch black and white for McNeil Lehrer, Sunny Walkman Pro, and a zillion tapes from Bach to Hank and back, Pocket Webster, Strunk and White, My Journal, Her Watercolors, What'd We Forget?
That really is, if you even kind of read it without, you know, without many pauses for breath, it was really just kind of a long run-on sentence.
List,
and
yeah.
So, I find myself thinking, what would that look like if it was a line poem? And would it be too long or too intimidating or, you know, off-putting to people?
Right.
I mean, it's very attractive, this little block of text.
Right.
Very self-contained.
Right.
So
that's, I think that's it. If I try to do lines, I mean, where would I have done the line breaks? And I was trying to just compress all of this into a small space, and that's the way I tried to read it. It's a long list of
It was wonderful.
Things.
I think I've heard that poem before, but I don't remember the part about the mousetrap. That was great. I like the breaking and entering. Taco chips.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, let's see. Let me take a look. Oh, what then? This sort of begs the question of the difference between hearing and reading a poem. So if I'm hearing, I mean, maybe it doesn't make a difference, but if you're hearing a poem, you're not seeing what it looks like on the page. So
right.
I guess that probably doesn't enter into the head of the poet. You're just giving the poem what form it needs.
Yes. I mean, a big part of my writing process, both as I'm writing and in revising, is to read the work out loud to myself, because I'm listening for rhythm and whatever is natural to me. So, the difference between listening and reading a poem, listening to and reading a poem, I think a lot depends on the reader and a lot on the poet. The poet, with his line breaks and that sort of thing, can give a signal to the reader how he wants it read. Garrison Keillor is a wonderful reader of poems.
Yes.
We have a poets group on Lopez, and what we do is we hand out poems at the beginning, and then we always have, if I've written a poem, I want somebody else to read it so that I can hear how they read it, and I can, and then I learn things from where they stumble. But every reader reads it differently.
Yes.
I don't know if I answered your question or not, Lorna.
Well, I don't know that there really is an answer. I just was kind of curious about it because I know that poets do put a lot of energy into the way it
right.
looks on the page. And then I was just thinking about going to a reading and listening to it.
Right.
And maybe it's the same thing because the way you put it on the page is to make it correct, right, for the reader to listen. And the way it gets read is also that
right.
way, unless somebody else is reading
yeah.
it. So.
I don't know. I have difficulty at poetry readings. If there's a lot of poems being read, really staying with them. And I remember seeing... I think it was a television program, maybe it was a recorded version of it, of Robert Bly. He used to read with that. He played some kind of a stringed instrument that he would play, but he would always read the poem twice.
Yes, I think that's good. I've seen those little snippets on PBS, maybe.
Yeah.
They have like a little 5-minute from the Geraldine Dodge Poetry
right.
Festival or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's really good to read it twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That helps.
Yeah. Let me take a... Well, when you started writing poetry, well, I know that you started out as an essayist, and then you went to writing poetry. And did you write prose poems right away, or did you write line poems? Or was there a progression between the kinds? Did you do one and then the next and then the next and then a little of all of them? Or
yeah, there was. Actually, when I started writing... Well, I'll just go back. Writing from as early as I can remember, I had the urge to write. I remember when I was a kid, I once wrote a... I decided to publish a neighborhood newspaper.
Oh.
So I spent about a week. It was one page, I think, on both sides, and had columns.
Yeah.
And I'd use crayons to do the photographs. I don't know what the articles were about. Probably about the neighborhood dogs and cats, which really interested me.
Yeah.
And then... I took I had wonderful English teachers in high school, and then took a creative writing class in college, which I loved. And I went on to have a business career, but I always wanted to get back to writing. So I started one thing that writing has done for me is that it helps me to think. So often when I'm having a troubled time in my life or that sort of thing, I turn to paper and pen to kind of work out what I think. And so I took a journal writing class at the University of Washington Night School from a poet in Seattle by the name of Pesha Gettler, and then read journals like May Sarton sort of thing. And then got interested once I retired from work, I started as a freelance writer, and I wrote for magazines, and I'm a musician, so I ended up writing for Music Magazine, which was great because I got to write about what I love and write. And then, so I did that for a number of years, and then I got interested in writing essays, and the influence there was... well, in high school, I read E.B. White, you know, One Man's Meat, and then John McPhee, who's a wonderful writer for The New Yorker, and also Scott Russell Sanders, who's a wonderful essayist from the Midwest. So I went to classes. I went to the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival for 2 or 3 years and studied with essay writers, as well as other... workshops. One was Fish Trap over in the Willamette Mountains in northeastern Oregon. And I wrote essays, and then...
What were the essays about?
I published a couple essays in the Christian Science Monitor about... one of them was about raising my sons, what I hope for them, and how they kind of went on their own way. And another one was about life on Lopez Island.
I remember that one because I had just moved here, and it was a little about how you considered it to be a good day when you never left the boundaries of your own property. See, you know you're a good writer when people remember what you said.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Well, I published a number of essays, but then I was drawn to poetry. I mean, I studied poetry when I was in high school, but I never thought I could write it until I read Raymond Carver's last book of poems just before he died. Which is titled A New Path to the Waterfall. And I had read his short stories and was really taken with them. And I think it might have been Patsy that gave me this book. But the, Raymond Carver died at the age of 50. He had lung cancer and then metastasized to his brain. It's an interesting story because he was a serious alcoholic and almost died from drinking, but he quit drinking 11 years before he died at the age of 50. And for 10 of those years, his partner was Tess Gallagher, a poet from Port Angeles. And it was a tremendously productive period for Carver. And so his last book, which was published, he and Tess Gallagher had worked on this book during his last year when it was known that he was going to die. And it was published after he died. But it contained some older poems, and it contained, he was reading Chekhov at the time, and Tess Gallagher had experimented with taking passages from Chekhov's work and writing them as poems. And Carver had written a couple of books of poetry before that, maybe three. But I was just taken with the style of his writing. It was in very plain kind of conversational language. He used humor. And the poems were totally accessible, and I just thought, gee, maybe I could do that. So that's he was the first big influence.
He inspired you then to give another kind of writing a try.
And he also he kind of in this book he blurs the lines between poetry and prose. There's some pieces of prose in here. Some of them might be never heard of them referred to as prose poems, but they were both, and there's a wonderful introduction that was written by Tess Gallagher in this book where she talks about their life together and about the process of putting this book together just before he died. And
did you want to read something from that?
Yeah,
could
read a poem. I'll read a poem or two.
Okay.
This one's titled What the Doctor Said. He said it doesn't look good. He said it looks bad, in fact, real bad. He said I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting them. I said I'm glad. I wouldn't want to know about any more being there than that. He said, are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help? When you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms, do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments? I said, not yet, but I intend to start today. He said, I'm real sorry, he said. I wish I had some kind of other news to give you. I said, amen. And he said something else I didn't catch. And not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, and me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. It was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me. I may even have thanked him, habit being so strong.
Mm. That is strong stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
The book is really very moving. And then there's another very short poem. It's four lines, two stanzas, titled Quiet Nights. I go to sleep on one beach, wake up on another, boat all fitted out, tugging against its rope.
I have to confess I didn't know that he wrote poetry. I just loved his short stories. So, I'm going to have to look some of those up.
Yeah. I recommend this book highly. I go back to it often, and Tess Gallagher's essay at the beginning is really interesting and very moving. So he was the one that made me think, well, maybe I can write poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I did, and I went to some workshops, I ended up going to night school at the University of Washington for 1 year in the mid-90s for a night school poetry track that they did. I went three quarters, studied with two wonderful poets down there, Stephen Thomas and Bell Randall, and it was a great group of poets, and they still meet in Seattle, that group from that 1 year. And so then I learned to write. We had to write in forms, you know, sonnets, villanelles, mm-hmm. all that sort of thing. It's a wonderful experience. So that's kind of what got me going.
Well, it sounds like you've really studied poetry and writing quite a lot. And it sounds like it's been not just helpful, but really important to you.
It has.
In refining probably what you do. So it sounds like it's a good thing for anybody who wants to write poetry to take some classes.
I think so.
It can only improve the
It's not
work.
Only what you hear, what you learn from the teacher, too. It's the other students. You learn so much from them. And in that case, I ended up in a writing group down there that I did go to for some time. As I say, it's still going. So that's good. But everybody comes to it in a different way, I guess.
Yeah, no, I imagine that's true. It seems to me that, I guess any kind of writer, whether you're writing poetry or prose, you see the world differently than the average person.
Right.
Moving through his or her days.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what makes, that's what makes a writer, people who can see, or maybe if being a writer helps you to see more, I don't know. Which comes first?
I think the process, it's a process of discovery,
mm-hmm.
writing. Kuser said, it is through the process of writing that ideas and feelings emerge.
I totally agree with that. I've found that to be very true in my own writing,
right.
as a way to get to peel the layers away and to get to what's really underneath. And
right.
all of it, of course, is so universal. But the process of doing the archaeology is important to get to what's really there.
Right.
Because oftentimes we don't really know what we feel or even what we see or what we think until we put it on the page and can say, oh, I didn't know I thought that.
Yeah.
Journals or poems or memoir. You have been reading from some other people, poets who have inspired you, and I wonder if you would read, you've read a couple of your own. Could you read a couple more of your own right now?
Yeah.
Do you want to take a drink of water first?
No, I just had a drink of water, I'm okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Well, you mentioned car poems. This is a poem, an early poem that I have written a bunch of car poems. I guess like most young boys, I was really taken with cars when I was young and as a teenager. And I'm probably fortunate I survived those years. This is titled My Father's Business Coupe. It had its comforts. Beneath the seat, a pint of old granddad in a brown paper sack. Behind the seat, a bag of peanuts, shells and all. And in the glove compartment, a bottle of Listerine that did a lazy roll when my father shifted gears. On the dash, a knob, block letter C, that he pulled each morning. Cold-blooded these Chevys, he'd say. Then he'd put his foot on the starter, the one to the right of the gas that looked like a wrinkled toadstool, and push himself back into the seat. And that business coop would growl. After a while, he'd stop, thumb back his hat, flooded, son of a bitch. Then a sidelong glance at me. We'd wait in silence. The best part was the transmission, how it howled in second gear. Not a car sound, an animal sound. And I could hear it a block away, my father coming home.
That's so beautiful, not only in itself, but in harking back to a different time.
Yeah.
That a lot of us can remember.
Yeah.
And the young boy's perspective. Lovely.
Right. Thank you. See what else I brought with me. Well, I could read another poem from memoir I'm working on, which the working title is Open Road, and it's about this trip that Patsy and I took when we were 50 years old. For 1 year, we were on the road. I kept journals and notebooks because I thought maybe someday I'd like to write about that. I'd been bitten by the writing bug. I'd taken a class on journal writing, and so I have all these notebooks. And about 10 years ago, I attempted to do something with it and couldn't. And so then about a year ago, I started again, and I tried to write a memoir with poems only, which I discovered didn't work for me, because there's so much exposition, there's so much explanation that you have to do in writing a memoir that for me it just didn't work. So then I decided, well, maybe I could write it in prose but include poems. And so, as you know, you're in our writing group, I had doubts about whether that would work, but everybody in the writing group said, no, go for it, do it.
Absolutely.
So I'm...
Plus, John, your prose is very poetic.
Oh.
So there's no hiccups anywhere, you know, that I've seen.
That seems to be going well. I mean, Karen Fisher said you can think of the poetry as a scene.
Yes.
In the memoir. And so I'd like to read from that. The structure of the memoir is I'm just following the trip chronologically. We left Seattle in June and worked our way across the northern part of the country. We went up into Canada. We ended up in New England in the fall. And then when the weather turned, we headed south down the Atlantic seaboard, spent the winter in Florida and along the Gulf, spring in New Orleans, and then... And then worked our way up into the west, Santa Fe. We spent a month in Santa Fe and eventually came back home in June. So this is a little bit of prose and then a poem. And the poem is a villanelle, which is a form, a poetic form that has an end rhyme pattern, and then also where lines are repeated in stanzas as you work your way down through it as kind of refrains. So we were in Northeast Oregon, headed for Idaho in late June. So I'll start with the prose and then go to the poem. After two nights at Jubilee Lake Campground, we descended State Route 204 toward the town of Elgin, the first 12 miles on gravel, where we encounter a lone backpacker who waves, and later a road grader making its way to the summit. The hills are decorated with color, and we stop often to pick yet another species for Patsy's collection. The poem is titled Brown Eyes with Wildflowers. With pencil and pad, she sketches each part, pistil, stamen, and stem. She sits with her cuttings and takes up her art. Through high country June, we stop, we start, paintbrush and yarrow and white penstemon. With pencil and pad, she sketches each part. I scramble through rocks, climb outcrops, ramparts. She shouts from below, to your left, purple. Then, surrounded by cuttings, returns to her art. Still lifes and landscapes from the color wheel's arc, blue camas, yellow ground cell, violet-white lupin, with water and brush she renders each part. Up on that ridge, would you mind, sweetheart? Hawksbeard, I think, careful of snakes. Then she turns to her cuttings, refining her art. I tap on my watch, time to depart. She pays me no mind, eyes a blossom again, and with pencil and pad traces each part, surrounded by cuttings, lost in her art.
So lovely. Was that hard to write?
Yeah. It took a lot of time.
Did you start out trying to write a villanelle? So it's not like you had a poem you thought, well, I'll try to convert it.
I just had an idea that I would try and write in a form. And I might try some other forms, too, in this memoir.
I actually had a question about the forms of poetry, because it seems like most poems don't rhyme anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It seems generally kind of old-fashioned, although some of the greatest in earlier centuries always wrote in different variations of rhyme. So I was actually going to ask you what you thought about poems that rhyme. I mean, it used to be the only way. I mean,
right.
Variations of rhymes.
Right.
But I don't even know when that changed.
I think it was when free verse came in, and I don't know when that was, maybe decades and decades ago.
In the last century?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine people who first started writing like that were scoffed at.
Right.
And
probably
now
it was considered not a poem.
Yeah. I just thought that was an interesting evolution.
Yeah. Writing in forms, that's a form, villanelle, and there was an end rhyme scheme there.
Mm-hmm.
First and third line had to rhyme, and then the middle line, there's stanzas of three, and the middle line of each stanza, the last word has to rhyme.
I noticed that when I have seen that poem on the page, and it was
right.
Very clear looking at it.
Right.
And hearing it, of course, it comes through too, but you don't always get it right away. It's like
right.
In the middle you think, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I've heard that sound before.
And there's other ways to use rhyme. There's slant rhyme, which is words that aren't exactly rhyme, but they're close. And then internal rhyme, where the rhyme is not in the, at the end of the line,
oh.
but somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Writing in forms is difficult. But I found when I took this class at the University of Washington, it was a really valuable experience, because when you write in forms, like there's a form where it's like syllabics, or like a haiku where so many
mm-hmm.
syllables, so many lines, etc., there's these rules.
Mm-hmm.
By writing within those rules, you're forced. It's amazing what comes out. What you produce, because you have to
conform.
You have to conform.
Yeah.
I think rhyme poems can be, they're very difficult to write, because they can easily become very sing-song,
mm-hmm.
and not make sense. The poet's pushing too hard to make
mm-hmm.
a word. So, I think it's a good experience to write in forms. It's just it's not real common.
Wonder how Shakespeare would write today.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the other side of that, I mean, I see this with a lot of the poems that Garrison Keillor publishes, and I see it in a lot of poetry. It's like it could just as well have been a few paragraphs of prose. It really isn't poetry to me.
I've seen that too. I've wondered sometimes.
Yeah. Kuser has a great quote about that, Ted Kuser. He says, you once asked, I listened to some of your other interviews, you asked a couple of writers, what's the best writing advice you received? And Ted Kuser said, poetry goes beyond mere anecdote. He said, you need to put more pressure on the language. You need to really think about your word choices. You need to think about using devices like simile and metaphor and all those things. So I guess on the other side of your question, what I see in poetry today, I really question whether it's poetry at all. It could just as well be, as I say, a couple paragraphs of prose.
I have often thought it would be fun to just take something I'd written in prose and just see what it would look like.
Should do it.
Yeah. I don't know. It'd be a pretty long poem. But, well, you know a good poem when you hear it or when you read it. I don't know. It's probably going to constantly evolve like it has over the centuries, so it'll be fun to see. But your grandchildren, your grandsons write. They must have your writing gene, too.
Yeah, some of them are good readers and good writers, too. I have a grandson who just sent me up something he published in his high school paper that was really excellent.
That must have been pretty exciting.
Yeah, it is.
I've been having such fun talking to you, John, that I've been forgetting to remind people that I'm Lorna Reese, and you've been listening to Lopez Writers Read, and we've been talking with John Sangster today. So I've got a few more questions, although I see we don't have a lot more time, but we have enough. Do you use poetry to understand yourself in the world? Well, I guess you've already said you use it to help understand yourself. You didn't use those words.
Yeah.
But
I do. I write to find out what I think.
Yeah. But when you start, does an idea or a phrase come into your mind, or what is the genesis of a poem for you, if there is any such standard thing? Are you walking along and you see something, or you hear a line in your head, or
It can be anything, really, but I think for me it's often it's from just starting the pen across the page.
Without an idea at all about what you're
going
to come out?
Yeah, just do a free write, or maybe something occurs to me. In thinking about this interview, I thought about that question, and I wrote, I think the best poems come from the corner of my eye. Rather than a rational decision, I will write a poem about something.
Mm-hmm.
So something occurs to me, like either from starting the pen across the page in some kind of a free write, or something I read. A lot of poems come from something I've read, or something I hear, a snippet of conversation, or something I see, or a dream.
A dream.
Yeah, the first poem I ever wrote, I didn't bring it with me, but it was from a dream, and it was, the images were thistles going to seed in my pasture and broken dishes in the kitchen. There was a line, shards on the kitchen floor. And it was from a dream, and that was the first poem I ever wrote, and I didn't understand it.
But it needed to come out, or somehow...
It needed to come out. And then later I did understand what I was writing about. At the time I was suffering from a lot of pain from arthritis and having a hard time just seeing how I was going to go on. So I think that's what that poem was about, just dealing with what was going on in my body.
Mm-hmm. The dreams are, I think, a way of giving us information about things that we're not consciously aware of. So doing free writing is the same thing. You're getting to the other side of the brain, and you get stuff that's inside and not conscious. So.
And the other thing is, for me, the subconscious is a big part of the writing process. And I'm a streaky writer. I'm either writing or I'm not. If I get stopped, then it's hard to get started again. It's a fear thing, I can't do this, it won't be any good. But when I am writing daily, the subconscious is kicked in. It wakes me up in the middle of the night with a word or a phrase or a solution to a problem I have, and I'll write it down in a little notebook and go back to sleep. So that's a big part of the writing process.
Yeah, it does seem to me that it would be more that way than thinking someone would write a poem about a certain thing. Well, I was going to ask you because it's such hard work. I wondered why you do write, and why poetry versus prose. But it does sound. I mean, I think with real writers, they have to do it.
I do. Yeah. I'm a much happier human being when I'm writing.
Yeah.
Than when I'm not. There's something missing when I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife Patsy once said to me, "It helps keep you sane."
Yeah. No, I think. I mean, for some people, if you don't have to write, some famous writer did once say that if you don't have to write, don't do it because it's really very, very difficult. People think it's easy to write. Have you noticed that? People think, I could.
Yeah.
And it's not.
No, it's hard.
It's like you're pulling your insides out, for one thing.
But it's
a great discipline.
It is, but it's for me. It's a very rewarding experience. I mean, William Stafford. I heard him. He's a wonderful poet from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, I know his work. Yeah,
and he said I would give all of my poems away for the experience of writing the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way. I mean, it's just such a rewarding experience to do the process.
And how about then when you get the recognition? Is that how important is that?
It's nice.
Yeah, it is nice, isn't it? The validation and the recognition.
Right.
I wondered if there's a question you wish I had asked you, or if there's anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to say about your work or your poetry, or if you want to read another poem or.
I guess I could read one more poem, if I can find it. I had a business career when I got out of college and graduate school, and I started as a CPA and worked in public accounting. Then I went into small business, and I had my own small business, and for many years it was a success, and then it failed, and that was... a really, really difficult time for me, and so much later, after that happened, I did try and write about it. So this is titled, What He Wouldn't Be Thinking About. How he'd leave the office, drive aimlessly around the city, creditors' calls still ringing in his ears. How he listened to the radio for news that the whole business world had caved in, but the news was the same as the week before and the week before that. How he sat at the lunch counter watching the waitress, hearing her patter with the regulars, for her another day. How he asked each employee to come into his office one by one, packing boxes alone, loading them into the station wagon, waiting in the empty office for people to buy the last of the typewriters, the old wooden waste baskets, hating their questions. What happened here? What will you do now? How he told himself things could be worse. How, in a way, he felt free. How someone said, remember, Ted Williams struck out 700 times at bat. How it hadn't helped. He'd turned his back now and wouldn't be thinking of that.
I like that you reveal some things that in that poem, and probably your others too, things that people don't ordinarily like to talk about in their lives.
Right.
And what was the title of that?
What He Wouldn't Be Thinking About.
So I was interested in titles too, because your titles are always kind of provocative. And how hard are they to come up with? Or do you pick a line from the poem, or do you just know? Do titles come easily to you?
I guess yes, in most cases. But they're an important part of the poem, titles. I think it was Kuzer said, does it make the reader want to read the poem?
Mm-hmm.
So they're an important part. Sometimes I just use the first line of the poem is the title. So they're important.
And one last question. Oh, actually, I don't think I have time for one last question. This is the longest program that I've done, I think. I'm always kind of watching the clock to make sure I don't go over. But we have been talking today with John Sangster about his poetry and his writing work, and it's been and some of the people who have inspired him and some of the poems that he has loved. You can read some of John's work on Shark Reef, which is, as I said earlier, the literary magazine of the Lopez Writers Guild. Just go to sharkreef.org for that and plenty of other fine writing. Now, John, you've published a few chapbooks. Where can people read or buy your work?
Well, Phyllis at Isle Haven Books has my chapbook, Island Year, and also Pudding House Press, which published it, has a website, so you can buy it online there.
Is it puddinghouse.com?
Puddinghouse.com, yeah, let me see. www.puddinghouse.com.
Thank you. You've been listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI FM 102.9. This program is being pre-recorded. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, write on.